This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Doctors and public health officials have been warning us for a while now about the spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, you know, superbugs. But as with most things, it's taken politicians a while to catch on. Well, things have finally gotten scary enough for world governments to meet to take action. Next week, the UN will meet in New York to discuss antibiotic resistance. And presumably, delegates will discuss scaling back the unnecessary use of antibiotics on animals and humans in countries around the world. Now, why is this necessary? And what would an agreement, what might it look like? With me to discuss these questions is Laura Kahn, a physician, a research scholar at Princeton University, and author of the book One Health and the Politics of Antimicrobial Resistance. Dr. Kahn, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much, Ira.
Well, we've been talking about this stuff, antibiotic resistance, for years. Why finally is the UN now meeting to discuss it?
Well, the World Health Assembly met in May 2015 to deliberate on this issue, and they realized that it is much broader than just human health. It involves animals, agriculture, the environment, and they realized that it needed a political input. So they moved it up to the UN General Assembly.
Mm-hmm. So it's become such an important issue that politicians are finally getting involved in the use of antibiotic resistant drugs?
At the global level, yes.
Yeah. Are there differences in opinion among the countries meeting next week when it comes to this issue?
Well, certainly. The poor developing countries are concerned, and justifiably so, about feeding their people. So, I mean, for developed countries like the United States, more concerned about antimicrobial resistance, we don't have concerns about food security at this point. So for us, you know, antibiotics are the foundation of modern medicine, but we can't forget that agriculture and the food security that it provides is the foundation of civilization itself. And so for a lot of countries that don't have food security, that they still have many, many hungry people, and let's not forget that the United States has some hungry people too, this is a really difficult balancing act between figuring out whether or not we can feed ourselves sustainably and still have our antibiotics too.
So some countries are more concerned about feeding their people than worrying about the use of antibiotics at this point.
Seemingly, yes.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the worst offenders when it comes to overusing antibiotics? I'd imagine that the U.S. is high up on that list.
That's right. Well, India, China, and the United States are the top three users totally in use of antibiotics. Now, of course, India and China have over 1 billion people each, but both have specific challenges that they face. So, for example, according to UNICEF, of the 7+ billion people on the planet, there are about 1 billion who are openly defecating, meaning that they're going out into fields, squatting, and doing their business. And of this 1 billion, about 600 million live in India. So, as a result, India has serious disease problems. They've got diarrheal diseases, malnutrition, childhood stunting. They have a very high disease burden. And as a result, they are very high users of antibiotics. And not helping the fact is that they provide antibiotics over the counter. So a lot of people just go and stock up on antibiotics. And whenever they feel a little sniffle coming on, they take them. And that all increases the resistance of the bacteria, and it shouldn't come as a surprise that India has some of the most resistant bacteria in the world.
They have. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, counter that with China. You know, China's also got to feed 1 billion people, and they have some of the largest pig farms in the world. They have pig farms of over 10,000 animals. They use antibiotics extensively because the sanitation's not so good. And one study found that antibiotic-resistant gene residues in the manure of these large swine farms are up to 28,000 times greater than farms that don't use antibiotics. And, of course, all of this manure gets into the soil and the waterways and the coastal waters. And ultimately, we are altering the global resistome in ways that we don't understand. Now, many of the antibiotics that we have come from soil bacteria. And so by placing all of this manure with increased levels of antibiotics and resistance genes, resistant bacteria, mixes in with the soil microbes, and it's not good. All of this then, of course, gets into the wildlife, and particularly birds. They're flying all over, defecating. They're spreading resistance genes far and wide.
So I hear what you're saying is that the manure, the fecal material that people leave behind are the breeding grounds for these superbugs.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't help. I mean, in addition to taking excessive amounts, we excrete large amounts. It gets into the environment, and it helps generate multi-resistant bacteria. So it's a major global problem.
Are we like...
Involving humans, animals, and the environment. And I just want to put a plug into the One Health concept. And this is a simple concept that human, animal, and environmental health are linked. And because they are linked, we must address these complex issues such as antimicrobial resistance in an interdisciplinary way. That's the only way we can do it.
Tell me what you mean. How would we address it that way?
Well, we can't look at just the humans. We have to look at the animal health and the environment. Now, as I had mentioned, the soil bacteria provided a lot of our antibiotics. Now, we don't know what most of the soil is composed of. We've only been able to isolate the soil bacteria. About 1% are able to be grown in the lab. So we really don't know what's in the environment. Now, some scientists have come up with a clever strategy called metagenomics, where they extract DNA directly from the soil, and they don't, unfortunately, know exactly what bugs the DNA is coming from, but nevertheless, we're able to see what's in that DNA. And what they discovered is that there are antibiotic resistance genes literally all over the world. They're in the Arctic permafrost, they're in Antarctic lakes. They appear to be ancient and everywhere. And by blasting the environment with all of our antibiotic use, we are increasing the expression of these genes. We are altering the global resistome.
Wow.
So
wow.
We need to look at it from that perspective in order, a holistic interdisciplinary perspective using both medicine, veterinary medicine, agriculture, environmental health, all of these things play into it. It's not just trying to cut back on, you know, on use.
Yeah. What would you hope comes out of this UN meeting?
Well, first of all, it would be very nice if sanitation and hygiene were improved around the world. In the 21st century, no human should be openly defecating. That should be a priority. That, you know, you can't just expect people to cut back on antibiotics if they're getting sick. So we need to, you know, prevention is, of course, the best medicine. Sanitation 101 is basic public health. And there should be nobody openly defecating. So that's one thing that I would hope would come out of this, is just to lower the disease burden that so many countries have. Number two, we need to implement genomic surveillance. And by that, I mean that what we've been doing so far up till now is when we look at these resistant microbes, we are only looking at the resistance genes. And it's akin to looking at people's hair color. So let's say, for example, I put everybody with red hair on the planet in a large room and try to figure out how they're related to each other based on their hair color. We simply cannot do it. You need to monitor their genome. You have to see what exactly is in their DNA. Now, before 2008, the cost of sequencing an entire genome was prohibitively expensive, like over $100,000. Since 2008, the cost of sequencing genomes has dropped markedly, allowing researchers then to include that technique in their surveillance. And hospitals now are just at the very beginning of starting to use this technology. And when you do that, very interesting things come out that is surprising. That, you know, not all of these bacteria, you make assumptions of where they're coming from, but they don't always act in ways that we assume.
There are researchers are saying, you know, maybe if we come up with new vaccines or new kinds of antibiotics, what kind of research is on the cutting edge? I know that you also talk about going backwards sort of to old phage therapies.
That's right. I'm a big proponent of bacteriophages. Now, certainly vaccines would be an important strategy, and we do have some vaccines against bacterial disease. We need a lot more. I mean, as I said, prevention is the best medicine, and vaccine acts by like a boot camp for your immune system. So if your immune system recognizes the bug, and a vaccine has basically weakened or deactivated bacteria or parts of them, it gives your immune system kind of a heads up when it encounters a real one in your day-to-day life.
How much money is being spent on new kinds of drugs? Is it high priority with the drug companies?
Well, most pharmaceutical companies have gotten out of the vaccine production because they don't view it as profitable. Similarly with antibiotics, too. A lot of them have gotten out of the antibiotic research and development because it's not considered profitable. You only take antibiotics ideally for a couple of weeks and then you're cured. Contrast that with drugs that you take for chronic diseases like high blood pressure or diabetes. In many cases, those are required for a person's lifetime, so it's a lot more profitable to do that. But let me just get back to the bacteriophages. They are tiny little viruses that look kind of like lunar landing modules. They are the most prevalent bioform on the planet, and they are bacteria's natural foes. There was a lot of interest in them in the beginning of the 20th century, but when antibiotics came on the scene, they were abandoned.
Well, Charlie, so you're saying we should try to... I'm running out of time, unfortunately, but you're talking about going back to bacteriophage therapies.
Yeah. All right. I think that would be a good strategy.
Dr. Laura Kahn, physician and research scholar at Princeton University. One Health and the Politics of Antimicrobial Resistance is her book. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about Compaq Computer after this. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In the early 1980s, if you remember back then, IBM dominated the market for personal computers to the point where Intel was giving them priority. Software made for one company's computers, which wouldn't run on others. And the only portable computer on the market had some frustrating shortcomings because of that. But all of that was about to change because in 1982, three friends met with an industrial designer in a Houston House of Pies, a restaurant still there. And they walked away with the design for the first IBM-compatible portable computer. They sketched it on the back of a placemat. And from there, Compaq became the fastest company to enter the Fortune 500. And within 5 years, they were making $1 billion in sales per year. Compaq, eventually joined by other small computer makers, led the charge in pushing software compatibility and portability, and they eventually put giant IBM out of the PC business. Silicon Cowboys is a new documentary film about this real-life David versus Goliath tale, and after its premiere at South by Southwest this spring, it opens in select theaters nationwide today. Director Jason Cohen is here in New York to talk about it. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great, great film.
I loved it.
It starts out as the story of these three friends. You have Rod Canyon. You tell us who they are.
Sure. Rod Canyon, Bill Murto, and Jim Harris are the three founders. And as you said, they did draw up the first sketch on the back of a placemat in the House of Pies diner in Houston.
And the three engineers who they quit their jobs at Texas Instruments, right? To start this company.
Correct. They quit with not even having another job or even an idea yet of what they were going to do.
All right. Well, we actually tracked down Rod Canyon. He couldn't be here with us today, but he did sit down and share some of the stories with us yesterday in New York.
We had gone over to Bill's house in, I guess, if you go back to September of 81, with just the idea of, okay, let's start a company. Now, how do we do that? And we really didn't know. Nobody that we were with knew how to do it. So we bought an entrepreneur's manual to try to figure out what the basics were. And then we started trying to figure out, well, you know, what do we really want to do? Now, the idea for a Mexican restaurant came up because we had always joked about, well, we ought to go do a Mexican restaurant. Fortunately, that was really kind of kidding, and we quickly got past that and began to try to decide what we were going to do. And we knew it needed to be something in the personal computer arena, because that it was IBM entering that market that caused the market to explode, and we knew that's where the opportunity was. So let's figure out something. Now, to be fair, we never thought we would build a personal computer. That was too big a thing. You know, we're just three guys starting up. We need to do something small. But after a while, the idea for this portable computer that ran IBM software came up, it was like, wow, that's too good to pass up. Let's go see if we can figure out how to do that. So we started down that path, and that was really like stepping onto a rocket platform.
That was Ride Canyon. What made this story so interesting to you?
You know, it's a great narrative. I mean, it's as you said, it's a David versus Goliath story. And yes, it's about computers, and I know not everyone can follow the language of computers. I can't follow a lot of it, to be perfectly honest, although I certainly am a bit more educated than I used to be. But it's a story that anyone can relate to, of the little guy taking on the big guy and succeeding and sort of stopping the bully. And it affects us all today.
And Silicon Cowboys as a name?
Yeah, you know, I do have to give credit to Ross Dinnerstein, our producer, who came up with that title in the middle of the night, and he emailed us, and we all loved it, or texted in the middle of the night when he came up with it, because we had been searching for a title. But yeah, for us, Cowboys, obviously, these guys were from Houston, and we wanted to get that across. But they were also, you know, they're mavericks. They quit their jobs. They started this company with nothing, took a chance, and you know they had that spirit, and that is a Texas spirit. So the Cowboys sort of pertains to that as well.
In fact, Rod Canyon told us that he liked this label quite a lot.
We really were cowboys in the sense of it was the Wild West of the PC industry. It was just getting going. Anything went, you know, as long as you were willing to stand behind it. And there was a lot of risk involved. So you had to be willing to take risk if you were going to get anywhere. So it's truly was a cowboy kind of situation.
How were they treated when they came up with this idea by the industry? Did being an outsider help them actually succeed?
Yeah, and you know we've talked about that. They were sort of overlooked. They were down in Houston. Everything was going on in Silicon Valley, and then you had IBM out here in New York. And particularly IBM, and we have a couple of voices from IBM in the film that said this was just a blip on the screen. And that's after they had sold $100 million the first year. IBM was not paying attention. They were just this little company from Houston, and IBM had put so many other companies out of business by suing them with, you know, coming in with big lawsuits because they had copied the code, which Compaq was very careful not to do and did it well. But yeah, they were sort of overlooked, and it worked to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the first sketch of their product was on the back of a menu from the House of Pies.
A placemat, yes. A placemat.
And you actually went back to the same place to film?
Yeah, it was one of the most gratifying scenes that for me in the film. We went back there. The lovely people at the House of Pies sort of let us take over for a day. And fortunately for us, it's sort of a snapshot in time there. It looks identical to what it looked like 40 years ago. It was just perfect. And we had just had so much fun filming in there, and we filmed a reenactment of them sketching the placemat. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Mm-hmm. There were many companies out there that were also compatibles, but they had copied the IBM code used to run their software, but one of the monumental feats of Compaq's first year was reverse engineering this and Microsoft's IBM compatible operating system, so they did not violate the copyright. How did they do that?
It was laborious. I mean, it was a huge undertaking, and they really made sure they did it right, because if they didn't, they would have been sued, and they would have been put out of business. And they basically, you know, in the film, we say that one of the guys says it was like playing baseball blindfolded, because they couldn't even look at the manual from the IBM that had the code. If they had looked at it, then they would have been sued. And so they had to do it all from figure it out by, trial and error.
And Rod Canyon told us that this gave them an edge on IBM in later competition.
When we found out that we couldn't get a version of MS-DOS from Microsoft that was compatible with IBM, That was actually an assumption in our business plan when we got our original funding. And it was about a month later that we met with Bill Gates in a, sort of a back room in San Francisco and told him what we wanted. And he actually didn't know at the time for sure. So he went away and talked to his people, and we found out later that, no, they can't do that. They can't sell us what they sell IBM. That belongs to them. And as IBM is their biggest customer, they're not going to go reverse engineer it. And the realization that we had to go do it, it seemed like almost an insurmountable task. But we decided, nope, if that's the only way we can get there, we got to go do it. So we went just plowed forward and actually got it done. And now, that turned out to be, you know, it seemed like this is one little step here. But learning how to reverse engineer it ourselves was a technology that later on separated us from everybody else. So even down at the end of the decade, when we came out with a backward compatible high-speed bus, we were able to do that because we knew how to make things run all the old software. IBM didn't. Their bus was incompatible. And it was that difference really that led to the success of the industry standard over IBM.
And that industry standard was Compaq's response to IBM's attempt to dodge the compatibility entirely with something they called the microchannel, which allowed its computers to do much more, do it faster, but which other computer makers would have to reverse engineer if they wanted to keep up, right? Yeah. So.
Yeah, you know, the PS2, which is what they put out, was basically IBM's way to squash everybody. That was going to be it.
That's what they did.
This is what they wanted to do. They wanted you had to use, everything had to be IBM, and you couldn't use anything else with this new system, and they were hoping that was going to catch on, but it actually ended up failing pretty miserably.
What was the defect in IBM's microchannel?
It wasn't necessarily a defect in the actual computer, but the fatal mistake they made was that it rendered useless all of the previous software and peripherals that all their customers had already bought. So every company was going to be forced to buy everything new again, billions of dollars of equipment, and, you know, they're selling to huge companies. So I think that was the fatal flaw, I think.
So here's Compaq saying, hey, you know, you don't have to buy the new IBM stuff to run the microchannel.
Right. And
we've got stuff that will run on it.
Yeah, and they teamed up. It was called the Gang of Nine. They teamed up with nine other big companies, including Microsoft and Intel. And they got together and had a press conference, and they offered this for free. They offered this new standard for free to the whole industry to combat this, and it caught fire. And now that's what we are. That's what we use.
What about the machine itself? What made the Compaq better than? I mean, I had a K Pro at that time.
Yes.
There was an Osborne.
Yep.
There were these luggables, as we used to call them, like carrying a sewing machine around.
Sure.
What made their machine so much better?
So theirs was a luggable. It was 28 pounds. It had a nice leather handle on the top. It looked like a sewing machine. You know, we purchased a few for the filming, and, you know, had fun playing
around.
Still
around
with them.
To get them.
We found them on eBay. Yeah. I'll be honest, the shipping costs more than the computer, like three times as much, I think. You know, the reason why it really caught on was it was made well. It was revolutionary in its design at the time. And when you look at it, when you look at an iPhone and you look at that, it's mind-boggling. But the Osborne was the only one that had made a little bit of a dent. But this took it a step further. And then the IBM compatibility. They were the first ones to ever do this, where you could take IBM software and run it in this computer. And that was the dealers they took it to love that.
And was that the backbreaker for IBM? What forced IBM out of the PC?
No, that was just the beginning, portable, you know, and there were a few times where, that's what our story tells. It's sort of this up and down over a decade of where there's these sort of near fatal blows by IBM to Compaq, and they somehow dodge it each time. But there's a few times where they get pretty close to put, you know, potentially putting them under. But they're able to kind of move around it.
Did they ever make mistakes, Compaq, missteps?
Oh, yeah. And you know, we do talk a little bit in the film. You know, this was a 10-year window that we looked at, and it goes up until the time when Rod was ousted from the company that he founded, as well as, you know, the other founders.
Like
had
Steve
left.
Jobs was sent down.
And this was happening in the 80s when Jobs was forced out of Apple. Apple was sort of a much smaller player in the PC market back then. So we try to look at some of the pitfalls and some of the moments that didn't go so well for them as well in the film.
Mm-hmm. The documentary also covers some of the unique work culture that Compaq had, reminiscent of some of the perks of working at Google and other modern companies, as Rod Canyon told us.
You know, the movie mentions the free Cokes and the no parking, no reserve parking space, but you know, to me, those are sort of almost trivial. They flow from the basic idea of, well, whoever gets here first, you know, they ought to get the best parking place. And, you know, if we can provide Coke so people don't have to worry about having the right change at any point in time, then why not keep doing it when we're 10,000 people?
Mm-hmm. But, of course, all good things must come to an end.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, part of what we wanted to tell in the story was, you know, this startup that started with these three guys eventually became appeared a little bit closer to what they had railed against, which was a large corporate, you know, company with thousands of employees, and you lose some of that culture, and it's just something you can't sustain.
Mm-hmm. Talking with director Jason Cohen, director of Silicon Cowboys, which is a new documentary opening in the selected theaters nationwide today on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. What cities?
It's playing in, I think we're up to about 14 cities, New York, L.A., Chicago, Houston, of course, San Francisco, Miami, I think Boston outside of Dallas. So, and the other thing which we didn't mention is it's available on VOD now.
On demand.
On demand, on iTunes, Amazon, Google. You can log on right now and you'll see it on there.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any things that might not have happened without Compaq, if Compaq had not come along?
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot in the film about the impact they had on the mobile industry, because that portable was the first time people actually recognized that you could live in something closer to a mobile world and being able to take your work home and out of the office. So we talked a lot about, you know, with the iPhone, you know, some people, even one guy, one of our people in the film says you cannot get to the iPhone without the Compaq portable.
In fact, we have Rod Canyon talking about how he pictured a world in which Compaq had not been successful, and he did. He drew a line straight to the iPhone.
All of the clones would have ended up under IBM's thumb, and most of them would have gone out of business, and Compaq would have been acquired or gone out of business somewhere along the way. But more importantly to what we do today is because the industry standard stayed in place and actually strengthened, the technology advanced so rapidly during the 90s and the early 2000s. If it had been controlled by IBM, they would not have allowed the technology to come out nearly as fast, because that's part of what they did. They brought it out when it was on their schedule, not, you know, whenever anybody else wanted to. And so I'm absolutely sure that the technology would not have advanced as rapidly, and I don't think we would have had the technology needed for Steve Jobs to develop the iPhone in 07. And, you know, maybe it would have come 5 or 10 years later, but Steve didn't last that long. He died in 2011. And so I almost think we would have missed that whole era. Now, we had lots of smartphones and we had, you know, PDAs, but it was the breakthrough that his vision created that led to everything we have today.
You know, I was reminded of The Soul of a New Machine, that the book, when I was watching the film. What makes this a more compelling story than just another story about a computer company?
Honestly, a big part of it for me was it's a story that people don't know. You know, we all obviously know the Jobs story, and we know the Gates story, and we now know the Zuckerberg story. And this is a story that, you know, as Rod just said, you know, it had an impact. Things would have looked drastically different, and I don't think people realize that, and I don't think people knew about this this story. And it's just a great underdog story and how they did this.
Did they all land on their feet?
They all, you know, they all left the company and, you
Rich.
Know, they all did. They all did well. I mean, you know, at its peak, they were up to about $3 billion by the end of the 1980s before they left.
Yeah.
They've all gone on to do some consulting and things like that.
Wow. Well, it's a great story, and I highly recommend Silicon Cowboys, the documentary about Compaq computer, and it premiered at South by Southwest, and it's opening in select theaters nationwide and on demand.
You can just go to siliconcowboysmovie.com.
Oh, there you have it. Jason Cohen, director of the new documentary. We're going to take a break, and after we're going to talk about activity trackers and fitness apps, get all kinds of people to exercise. We're going to talk about where you can get them. Are all the badges and leaderboards and gimmicks just making the fit more fit? If a zombie is chasing you, do you run faster? We'll find out after the break. Our number, 844-724-8255. What do you think about all of this? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's face it, working out isn't everyone's idea of a good time. Run 5 miles? No, thank you. I'd rather play a set of tennis. But maybe what I'm missing is something that would make me make that workout a little more fun, a little more like a game. App developers and device makers have already thought of this, of course. There's Fitbit, which tracks your steps and gives you little encouraging buzzes on the wrist when you reach a goal. Other apps like Runkeeper and Strava, where you can log the miles you run, see how you stack up against your friends, and even compete against total strangers for speed and time. And if it's competition, if the competition is not your thing, how about being chased by zombies? That enough motivation for you? Because yes, as they say, there is an app for that. But do these things really work to motivate you? And do they have a dark side? What do you think? Do you use activity trackers or apps? Do you love them, hate them, can't live without them? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, or tweet us at SciFry right here, and we'll take your calls and your tweets. Joining me now are Margaret Wallace, CEO of Playmatics, a game development company based in Brooklyn and San Francisco, and she joins us from KQED today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. I just logged 5,000 steps on my Fitbit to get here.
Wow. See, even Science Friday can motivate people to become fit. I know you're not just a game developer, but you use this fitness stuff yourself. For those who haven't used a Fitbit, you say you got 5,000 steps on that. Are any of those Fitbit apps, are any of them good? Do you like them? How do they work? How do they motivate you?
You know, I've been a longtime Fitbit user for the past few years, and between Fitbit and the Samsung S-Health offering, those two happen to be my favorites, and I use them interchangeably. And over the past few years, I've seen especially Fitbit really grow and evolve with the community in terms of amplifying different features that use elements that we've always traditionally used in video games to potentially help encourage users or players or walkers to just keep going and give them the sense of how they're progressing.
You know, it must be true because in the new Apple Watch that's coming out today, when it was announced, they made sure you knew that it was going to be pointed toward fitness people.
Yes, and as I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners already know, a lot of this impetus comes out of what we call the quantified self movement, which is basically just using personal data and data in ways to hopefully help optimize people's experiences. In this case, we're talking about fitness and activity tracking, but it can be used in a whole range of other areas, such as health. My new Fitbit Charge 2, for example, it measures my heart rate passively. It's a great feature. I love it because it shows me resting heart rate and also active heart rate.
But, you know, the whole thing I mentioned before is that if you're not into just keeping track of these things, if you find those things really boring, they're now trying to gamify it, right? Make a game out of being fit to help you motivate. For example, I know you're a Walking Dead fan, and you have your own Walking Dead podcast, in fact, right?
Yes, I do, Zombie Jamboree.
Well, tell us about the app, Zombies Run. What's the idea there? Are zombies really chasing you and you run faster to get away from them?
Yeah, Zombies Run is one of the great, I would say, milestones in terms of how different people with a game development background and creating apps have applied narrative to helping encourage fitness. So Zombies Run is basically what it sounds like. I have different stories or scenarios that unfold that entail, oh, I don't know, hordes of zombies chasing me. And it encourages me and keeps me you know, active and not necessarily focused on how hard my run is, but it's attempting to immerse me in a story. And a lot of us, and especially a lot of us in Western culture lately, with the popularity of things like The Walking Dead, are very tuned into what it means to be chased by zombies.
Mm-hmm. Have you designed an app about being chased by zombies?
I had the pleasure to work on a Walking Dead related app a few years ago. Right now, my company, we're working on taking different device tracker APIs, and we're working to build that into a game right now that we hope to be in what we call closed beta in the winter, like January.
Can you give us an idea of what kind of game that would be?
So basically, what we've found, or what our thesis is that activity trackers provide a wealth of information, and they've only just begun to start to tap into the power of story and narrative and the power of using these game-like mechanics, not only to entice you to start working out or at least being aware of how active you are, but to keep you engaged. And so that's sort of our theory. And what we're going to do is we're looking for creative ways to incorporate fitness data that is provided naturally through these various services. They have what is called APIs, so that allows software developers like myself to plug into certain tools and libraries that they use. And we're hoping to use that data to create a hopefully immersive experience. Zombies Run, like I said, did a great job of doing that. And we have certain ways that we think we want to focus on different kinds of exercise and see how that works together in a complementary fashion as far as creating engaging gameplay.
You know, when Pokemon Go came out, I don't recall it being promoted as a fitness game. Yet as people, a billion or so people downloaded it and used it, it turned out it was getting people moving who were never getting off the couch.
It's remarkable the extent to which Pokemon Go created such a movement. I mean, literally a movement of people. And I don't know if that was an intended feature. And that's what we call in gaming an emergent feature. That's something that we may not have necessarily anticipated when we made a game, but it's something that came out of it naturally because it's how the community and the audience likes to use it and discovered they like to use it. So Pokemon Go, I know it got me to visit places I never saw, both in New York, San Francisco, wherever I go.
Yeah.
With Pokemon.
We have folks who want to talk about it. Let's go to the phones. Our number 844-724-8255. San Antonio, Melanie in San Antonio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me. I use running apps pretty regularly, and I have been so for the last 4 years. I'm a half marathoner. And I found that they've actually helped decrease my mile splits by about 2 minutes.
Wow, that's a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot. Coming from being a non-runner to now running pretty regularly every day.
Do you find, do you use any of the new games, or do you, or are you just happy to have, you know, the Fitbit or whatever you use to stimulate you?
My husband's a zombie runner. He likes that one. And he is the biggest anti-runner possible. So anything to get him moving is fantastic. For me, I like the Nike Plus only because it's Apple Watch compatible. And I just the whole UI of it on the Apple Watch and being able to look down at it real quick at a glance to see, what my past mile was compared to the current mile. And I'm a competitive person by nature, so I always like to compete against myself on that.
Oh, thanks for sharing, Melanie, and good luck to you and your husband.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Margaret, just sounds like a success story there.
Well, you know, it's funny. Nike Plus, as a lot of you all know, has really led the way in terms of adding what I call game-like elements. Some people say gamification. It's just in a design approach to their apps. And Nike's stuff has been honestly the slickest and the most resonant. And honestly, I credit them for really starting an entire movement around the quantification of fitness, whether you're talking about Under Armour, Fitbit, Strava, Zombies Run. somewhere along the lines, every one of us have looked at what Nike's doing, you know, for better and for worse. I mean, they've had some troubles recently with their Nike Run Club feature changes. They took away challenges and the way that people were used to them working. But I think they've been working really hard to address that, and they're great.
You know, as Melanie was saying, she's a competitive runner. She talks about her splits and times. Isn't that a bit of a turnoff to some people that they're, you know, they sort of feeling they have to be competitive, these things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nike definitely has a wide range of audiences, but I think they certainly do tap into more of the competitive type of player. And we know that players do not fit all one size. There are different kinds of players and different kinds of day. You might be a different kind of player. And something that Fitbit has done to address that, that I think is really smart, if they've rolled out recently Adventures, which are these solo sort of non-competitive experiences where you can walk and experience what it might be to be on a trail at Yosemite. But they also have a Challenges, which can incorporate up to 10 of your friends. And so if I'm more of that competitive type of player, I have that option, but it can be demotivating to some people who don't want to share their personal data.
There's sort of a downside to some of these. Wasn't there a case a few years back where a cyclist died trying to beat a record on Strava?
That is what I've heard, and it's not surprising because in a lot of ways, I mean, if any of us have taken yoga classes, I mean, a lot of people say, you know, you're not competing to be better than the person next to you, or don't push yourself too hard, and some of these things can really tap into that overachiever way.
Let's go to Washington, D.C., to Hassan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I just had a question about the GPS information for different users and the retention policy and also the sharing of that information with law enforcement. How does that work with these fitness trackers?
Good question. Yeah, what happens, Margaret, to the data that get collected?
Well, that's a really great question, and I think we could probably spend a lot of time talking about it. Right now, I would suggest that the handling of the data is all over the place, and I would suggest that to really get down into how each company handles the data, you would really have to look at their terms and services and maybe even follow up with customer service. It is true that when you are sharing your whereabouts, you know, with Runkeeper, I can post the runs I do on a regular basis onto Facebook, for example. If somebody wanted to track my whereabouts, it wouldn't be difficult to see that, oh, well, every Friday, Margaret does this run. So there are certainly privacy implications. That was one of the biggest issues that the Nike Run Club faced recently in terms of whatever backlash occurred with the community, as they said, well, now the challenges are using hashtags. I don't want to share with the whole world what I'm doing. I don't want to use your universal hashtag. And so privacy and data and how that data gets used, it's a huge area that is only now starting to be understood in terms of the implications.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Margaret Wallace, CEO of Playmatics, a game development company. On the other hand, we are learning that the greatest motivators for people are their friends, people they know. Wouldn't that also be true with sharing your data with friends of yours, getting you to do more or having them encourage you?
Yes, I think, again, it really comes down to player type. And I think for a lot of us, we may not feel comfortable with sharing, hey, today I only did 5,000 of my 10,000 steps. Ugh, I blew it. I didn't make my goal. We feel comfortable sharing that with some people. Some people feel comfortable sharing that with everyone. They're not shy. But I think it really depends on, you know, where you are in terms of your fitness, how you feel about yourself, and what kind of friends you have. But I think that there are ways, again, the Fitbit Challenges allows you to customize. I want these 10 of my friends or these 5 of my friends to work with me together on this goal. And I think that has more benefits than negatives in the long run.
Is gamification moving outside the fitness realm? Maybe into, cars or something?
Gamification is is infiltrating, for lack of a better word, every single sector that I can imagine. Since, you know, my background is traditionally in the video game industry, but since this has become a thing in terms of design for apps and also real world experiences, we're seeing it in simulation and training. We're seeing financial institutions use this. We're seeing HR departments use it for looking for skilled employees in different areas. We are seeing it built into hardware. So certain automobiles will have different game-like elements in their dashboard to show you how fuel-friendly or environmentally friendly you're being with your driving or your style. Or your insurance companies are starting to utilize this with their apps to show whether a driver has been compliant and is eligible for less expensive insurance. It's really taking over in terms of a design approach in a lot of areas.
Is there one age group it's aimed at?
I would suggest since everybody plays games, right? Everyone of all ages plays games of one kind or another, or most of us do, whether we're talking physical card games or mobile games. It really isn't age specific. It's just the approach, I think, would be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. And where would the cutting edge be in gamification these days? I know you say you're working on something new. Well, you won't tell us what it is. I can respect that, but is there a cutting edge someplace?
Well, there is something that we're working on that I can talk about, and I can talk about other examples too. One is something that we're working with the Scripps Research Institute and Dr. Benjamin Goodwith. And what we have done is we are creating a platform to allow scientists and researchers from all over the world who have apps and online like activities that are helping them crowdsource scientific research, whether we're talking about astronomy or life science or biodiversity. And we're providing these researchers with the tools to build in badges and stuff like that.
That's great. Margaret Wallace, good luck to you. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Good luck with your game
work.
Thank
you, Ira.
Margaret
Thank
Wallace
you.
Is CEO of Playmatics, a game development company. One last thing before we go, for all our listeners in California, don't forget we'll be recording a special live show at the Mondavi Center in UC Davis. That's next Saturday night, the 24th of September. We've got Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, and lots of other special guests, and we'll be reanimating a tardigrade. Trust me, you don't want to miss this. This is at the Mondavi Center, UC Davis, next Saturday night, the 24th of December, the 24th of September in Davis. So don't forget, 24th, next Saturday, a week from this Saturday, next Saturday night in Davis. Just a few tickets left, so get them at sciencefriday.com/Sacramento. sciencefriday.com/Sacramento, 24th September in Davis. We'll see you there. BJ Lienemann composed our theme music, and it helps to the studios of the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.